In this episode, we finally arrive at a place where most people begin with the story of Lamarck and his theory of evolution. They mostly begin with the point of what this theory is and how it wasn't as good as Charles Darwin's theory of evolution that we associate with. So previous episodes have been about the flow of history up to this point in time, the tumult, the dislocation of the French Revolution, the story of how the animals arrived with to Lamarck for him to look at it, the story of his career, the different things, how he was embedded in history. He's just not a modern person placed there. He's a person that's had a career, been influenced by religious thinking in a religious world, in a world which has existed with education, which is unlike the education we experience today, which is industrialized and almost military education. So those fabrics come together to give a person who, through rational thought and looking for evidence afterwards, things which we would very cautiously say, we'd use the word cognitive bias. Of course, cognitive bias is something that we tend to throw around, but we tend to be very self-uncritical of our own cognitive bias. So this is, if you think something, you will look for the evidence of it, something that we do all the time, particularly if we look back on what we've done. In life, we tend to have a cognitive bias that every decision we make was somehow the best and we've somehow done the right thing. So getting back to it, Lamarck's theory of evolution. Knowing the modern mind, you want to know exactly what it is. Well, it is a theory of evolution that if you see one group of animals 1 year and come back 100 years later, they'll be ever so slightly different. Not radically different, slightly different. They will have evolved, and he called it phyletic, or phylum, from the phylums, groups of animals. Gradualism, that's gradual change. So that's evolution. And this was a thing that was a radically new idea, that when God put a species on Earth, that species trotted along forevermore with no change. So this is a major thing. So he had sufficient samples to see things changing. And one of the things he looked at is the development and devolution of organs. So in us, we've got the tonsils, appendix, earlobes, a whole lot of things which we could say, well, what's that for? And we don't have a real strong reason. We had it originally, but we no longer need it. In whales, it's the legs of whales. In us, we've got some organs which have been retasked, like our ears used to be, our little bones which raised our gills when we were fish. All these things suggest a gradual motion between the species. We didn't quite have the exact story of it. And his theory had, three principles. One, if during your lifetime you use it or lose it, it's if you use it, it'll get stronger. His second principle, if you don't use it, it'll get weaker, become vestigial. And the final component to put this into a system, a driving force, is that the characteristics that you encourage in your own lifetime and get transmitted forward down to the offspring. So if people, before they marry and have children, they really practice and do a lot of music and listen to music and encourage their musical ability, they will give birth eventually to a child with higher musical ability. Those people sort of laugh at this nowadays and say, "Oh no, what happens is that a musical couple will produce a range of children, and if music is essential for their survival, the ones which survive will eventually become more musical. The population itself will become more musical. And if you, this is Charles Darwin, you have another essential element is that you have to have an isolated population. Either physical isolation or the environment changes such that they have to make a choice between two strategies, so strategic isolation, so they can go into a different niche, and that means that the populations get reduced and they follow a different population mean as they go through, and the mean gets varied as you go through. So that's Darwin and Lamarck in a nutshell. And sort of Lamarck came up with a general theory of evolution and had big battles on his hands. And the big battles to us seem surprising, and he had a different approach. One of the different approach is more of rationalism, thinking things through and then looking for the evidence rather than collecting all evidence and seeing if I have a theory which fits all evidence, which is Darwin's approach, or the more rigorous science community approach. Now, this is an important fact, is that we're talking just at the dawn of what we recognise as modern institutions and modern processes. So in modern processes, we have a theory and we put it out for peer review before we publish it. At least that's what we do in the science community. And of course, this peer review process wasn't really up and happening in both Darwin's, and definitely not in Lamarck's time. You'd publish it, and if the publication was a success, it's okay. Or if it wasn't a success, the problems were that with it was a very public affair. And this, of course, corresponds to a world without telecommunications and processes. So the actual physical process of peer review would be incredibly complicated. So it would publish first and then peer reviewed later as a process going forward. So the same features of modern day science were there, but in slightly different orders, and the process of I suppose rationalism versus, or theoretical approach versus a experimental approach today gets very mixed up. But at that time, where places were so isolated, it didn't. And so going back, we looked at the career of Lamarck, having a religious, military, and political career all rolled into one, led to a certain window of advancement. Where you had to actually get a theory out, get people behind it, get it funded, and then just hope for the proceeds and advances to go forward. So this is the background for it. Now we have to, in this episode of Peter Hill Explains, cover really basically the actual steps in his theory. So this is not the career, this is the actual thinking steps that Lamarck came across, and it's an important thing to get a general background, as other points of interest, like people's relationships with animals, theories of animals, are good background information, but not essential to your school exam, multiple choice question about who invented evolution. Rather than that, this is looking a bit deeper, sort of looking at people's attitudes towards animals and how that affected how they interpreted Lamarck when he arrived on the scene, and people's general distractions. So there were a lot of people worried about revolution, losing their head, starving, a whole other features, and somehow this and new orders coming in, and how you thought. So it was very much an age of association. So if you associated yourself with the correct political group, you got powerful. But if that political group went from favour, it would be very much a roller coaster ride of favour, disfavour, and you had to be very agile minded to get through it. So Lamarck's theories. So he collected a lot of plants, as a lot of noble people did, and examined plants. And his ordering of plants, rather than by looking at sporadic features or looking at a key area of a feature, was more holistic and looked at the actual sophistication of plants. So he created a linear ladder of sophistication to order the plants. I think it's he wrote, I've forgotten what the French for it is, but the English rough translation is the plants of France. And going back to it, as discussed before, you publish it, and then if it sells a lot of copies, it's a popular hit, and people write reviews of it. A bit unlike we do nowadays, is peer review, do internal audits of the quality of the science, or tends to be that way in Australia at least. So this is a bit different. So he had the linear approach, and the series of his involvement in the revolution got him to set up a basic natural history museum / university. The museum is pretty much the same concept we have today. This is an educational facility for the populace as a on large. Now, swings and roundabouts, he set it up. His documentation was clearly essential for him. However, when it came to distribution of professorships, he drew the, we don't want to do this job, or let's solve the problem of a job that no one wants to do, plus a professor we really want to keep a bit at arm's length, and gave him the professorship of insects and worms. Now, if you come across it, what's the link between insects and worms? Or they both don't have backbone, so it's claimed at least that he got that sort of distinction of the animal kingdom going. But the insects themselves have a huge variety. It's the most numerous species on Earth. And dealing with that, he developed the next key thing with evolution, the increasing sophistication. But he also had the... So he had a linear model. Now he had a model with tree branches of it. So the tree of life. So the tree of life aspect of evolution came to him. The mechanism was very much based on the idea that new species arrived due to his process. Now, his process is, I suppose, superseded by natural selection. This is where you have a variation, you cull the, so genetic and other variations occur. So it's a spread of characteristics and then a harvesting, a selection of those characteristics. So in terms of a characteristic space, species go on a path led by computation. Computation by death. Natural selection comes by death, whereas, and so this involves a certain amount of killing. And so I think if you look at the original title of Charles Darwin, The Origin of Species, : and the Survival of Superior Races, definitely mentions in the full title of the book. If you see the original books, it's just not just The Origin of Species, it's also got a byline of the inheritance of superior races of animals, things along that line. Of course, this has been picked up by various political movements, let's say Nazism, I think it's eugenics, I don't know how you say it, looking at superior races and obviously helping evolution along its path by killing people. But then on the other hand, Lamarck has become the darling of the Stalinist era, the Soviet era, and you had Soviet scientists supporting Lamarckian theories going forward. Okay, well, let's get back to it. And so Lamarck had this generation of new species. Now, then you have the Cuvier, who is politically ascendant in the world that Lamarck set up. So he set something up, and he was second fiddled and eventually pushed out of the area by someone who believed in mass extinctions. And of course, we do believe in mass extinctions, but his theory was that God came along and removed all the animals, sometimes 95%, so that's if you have 20 types of species, you left and you, at the end of this event, you've only got one left. And the process of generating new species is God goes, oh, let's top up new species, and God introduces new species. And this sort of made sense at the time. So it was a scientific theory which really required, and God, so nowadays we would find that very, really difficult to publish. And of course, Lamarck also believed in God and said, well, God wouldn't actually just knock off a species. There's an event, and he will retask or retrain species for the new environment. So one of the other aspects of Lamarckian view on evolution is that there are changes or crises which cause a huge amount of evolution to happen. Now, that being said, that's his overall theory. So he started with the ladder, went to trees, and then this gradual change of species by environment. But he also said it was a non-constant thing. Now, we observe that in many cases. We see that the sudden bursts of evolution seems to have stable periods, and then also this is scientifically going back. So the I think it's called the Octavian explosion, which the explosion refers to not a physical explosion, things flying either side. It was the generation of new species. So basically, after the evolution of eyes in the sea, there was massive experimentation with body parts and body forms. And in Australia, we have in Sydney, in fact, I've never seen, although it's reported in Sydney's gardens, no one I've seen or met knows this, but it's well covered in the documentaries, the velvet worm. And this is a something pre-dinosaurs just walking around the garden. They're about 3 centimetres long, brightly covered, and they have about 100 stump legs, little stump legs, looking up, and they go around the place, and then they shoot slime jets and cover their prey with slime. And they're not arthropods, they're their own species, but from this area there is these bursts of evolution. And again, though the term, for some reason, people have taken a concept that evolution, these laws of nature, should be taken into society and be the basis of society. Sort of, if it's true in science, it must be true in society. And as far as I'm concerned, society can be is the one thing. It doesn't have to be bound by scientific laws and theories. But a lot of people have based their society on religion, and now they're going to base their society on science, whereas I'd perhaps base it on, if I was basing society, I'd base it on maths. So you've got the evolution going into other areas. Computer programs evolve. Your immune system is evolution. And there is some evidence that your immunity can actually be transferred. So what happens basically is that your lymph glands, to increase the rate of immune cell production, your lymph glands swell, so you get a factor of 10, because your gland swells up by 2.5, factor of 2, 2 cubed is 8, so it only has to expand by a factor of 2 to be 10 times as big. And your lymph system takes toxins in to taste, and cells bring up toxins, and then you go to a high temperature. And the high temperature, the reason you have a high temperature is that evolve. You have to out-evolve. A bug has evolved to eat you, and your only way to do is actually fight evolution with better evolution. So when you have a fever and sit down, it says, bets are off, guys. There's no more going around the world. You have to recover, and you are fighting evolution with evolution. And so this is just the tip of the iceberg of Evolution being an area, and so the evolution in terms of the species that we see at the moment, or the selection of traits for, that we do in artificial selection rather than natural selection. That's sort of one section of evolution. But there's all these other areas of evolution, the theory is that things could evolve by natural selection to achieve Lamarckian selection. That is, if you are sufficiently evolved, you can actually have your evolution, like you can be evolved to be better at evolution. These, in sort of mathematics, it's a second order differential equation. So again, I haven't actually seen that people, they look at a trait, but they don't look at the variability of a trait. So if under stress you have a giraffe, and one family has one family of giraffes has six giraffes within a small band of variation going up. Another one has variable variation. The variability, another family, because the greater variability is going to be the giraffe family, which can respond more quickly to an environmental input. So still, the environmental input gets put in the back foot, and you have a play out of life and death. And it's just whether you can actually, whether we have selected for Lamarckian variability. That's something to think of. So going back to the theory, Lamarck's theories, it's a response to environment, a tree of life. He doesn't like extinctions, but when you come down to it, really, it's really a footnote in both Darwin and the other. And he has his three impact processes. So he has an impact on the size of the organ, getting bigger or larger, and then the ability to transmit that to the next population. Now, on closing, there are events or things which are happening in populations which appear to be a genetic variation in response to environmental impact, and such that we can measure it. So there's a large population, so the overall height of humanity is definitely increasing. The milk tolerance is spreading through populations faster than Darwinistic events. The intelligence of the human population is increasing generation on generation faster than evolution can explain. It's called the Flynn effect. There's a whole series of things which we have to deal with. And now, I suppose the complexity here is that we've got a theory, and if you sort of just deal with it in a right or wrong or simple teaching for a test, it doesn't pull out all the complexities or the nuances involved. This is Peter Hill Explains, trying to explain science, trying to explain Lamarck's theory of evolution, and try and place it, what he did say and what he didn't say, in a more nuanced place. So keep on thinking science, doing science, and teaching science.